Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jeffrey Sachs, and I'm the director of ATID. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all here this afternoon for what I am positive will be a very rich, engaging, and dynamic afternoon and evening of discussion and dialogue. And despite the very serious, extremely serious nature of the topic which we come together to discuss, I also welcome you to an opportunity for collegiality, for dibuk chaverim. Among the goals that ATID sees itself striving to fulfill is to create an opportunity, to create an arena in which mechanchim from the broad spectrum can come together to discuss these and other issues, to meet and talk, and to be enriched and strengthened by the meeting with each other. I would like to especially thank and welcome the presence of the ATID Fellows, who are involved all year long in what we're doing. And I would especially like to welcome the members of the ATID faculty that are the backbone of our efforts. Particularly, I would like to thank Dr. Beverly Gribitz for her involvement in what we do all year long, and especially to welcome Rabbi David Ebner, who we'll be hearing from later, and to thank him for everything he does in ATID. And of course, it's important to point out that today's conference was his brainchild. But I would like to call to the podium for a few words of greeting the president of ATID and the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva HaNiftar, the man whose vision stands behind everything we're trying to do in ATID. I encourage you to read the materials in the packets or to visit our website to understand the broader spectrum of what ATID is involved in. Today's conference is one small aspect of what we're doing in trying to create a group of strong, young educational leaders. And it's my great privilege to call upon Rabbi Bravender, the president of ATID, to now open the program.
As is customary, Rabbi Sachs gave me a piece of paper on which is written all the things I'm supposed to do. ATID has produced a certain amount of incompetence in me, which Rabbi Sachs is trying to overcome. First, please ask people to register by filling out forms at the desk in the lobby if they haven't already done so. This is very important, and if you've done so, don't do it again. I want to thank the speakers and the participants, especially Dr. Ed Goldstein, who is here, although he had to change the time of return to America. Now, I have a lot to thank Dr. Goldstein for. In the school that I attended, in elementary school, it turned out somehow fortuitously that he was my Rebbe for my bar mitzvah lessons. And I think that that was the first contact I ever had with Avas Torah. So I thank you for that as well. I thank AIM, American-Israeli Metaplan, and especially the Solomon family for their support of this day. I'd like to add a word. This period of time between Pesach and Shavuot is a time when we accepted upon ourselves certain minhagim, certain customs of Avelut. And I wonder why this time, between Pesach and Sukkot, not which events, we all know about the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva and other events, but why this time, the time between Pesach and Shavuot, became the time of reflection through Avelut? You know, the Mishnah, there's a Mishnah in Eduyot in the second Perek, Mishnah Yud. which says that Mishpat Rishaim Begehinom Ishtem Asar Chodesh, that the wicked have to spend 12 months in hell. Shene'emar Vayami Dechodesh Bechotcho, a pasuk in Yeshayahu, that you have to wait until the month, I guess that's the pshat, until the month of the death rolls around again before you can escape the punishment of Gehinnom. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri says, min ha-pesach va'ad ha'atzeret, that the time that has to be spent in Gehinnom is Pesach ad ha'atzeret, she'ne'amar, midei Shabbat v'shabbato, the continuation of the Pasuk. So everybody knows that Pesach is called Shabbat, u'shvartem lachem mimocharat ha-Shabbat, the first day of Pesach, and Atzeret, Shavuot, is also called Shabbat, shu mimocharat ha-Shabbat ha-Shvi'it. And this is further indicated in a Pasuk in Tehillim. Yeshev olam lifnei ha-Elokim chesed ve'emet man yintziruhu. So it's clear to us that Pesach is the holiday of chesed. Everything is given to us. And it's also clear to us that Shavuot, Chag Matan Torah, is the time of emet. What the Pasuk says, and that what we feel, is that somehow the passage from the world of chesed to the world of emet is a difficult one. And I would connect that to what we are doing here today. Everybody knows that Rav Moshe Feinstein said about the American diaspora, Galut Shel Chesed. He used the word chesed in describing how good it was to live in America. Those of you who have been in Israel as long as I have, or even those of you who have been here less than I have, know that living in Eretz Yisrael is also a tremendous chesed on the practical level. And we found today that in educating our children, we have difficulty in this world of chesed in which we live in getting to the emet, which is the world of the Torah. So it's fitting that this conference, I think, which is a conference that describes the difficulty of getting from the world of chesed to the world of emet, takes place during this time between Pesach and Shavuot. I'd like to add that we all have to be thankful to Rabbi Sacks, without whom none of this would have happened, and who is really the driving force behind what happens on a day-to-day basis in Atid. Thank you. It's going to start by itself? I need to push a button.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Dodi Tobin, and I am the Director of Admissions and Recruitment at Nishmat. I am also a psychologist and an Atid Fellow. On behalf of Atid, I would like to welcome you to this very important event. Substance abuse is nothing new. We see it portrayed in the media. We see drugs dealt on the city streets. We've heard about the problems in the public schools. Perhaps we've been acquainted with someone who has had a drug problem, or heard of someone's child who has been in rehab. We may be familiar with the damage substance abuse can do to families, to academic performance, to our bodies. For so many years, we have considered substance abuse as a problem existing out there in the secular culture, not in our frum community. Unfortunately, we have come to a time where we can no longer ignore that the problem of substance abuse exists in our midst. Like other societal ills before it, substance abuse has become a reality in our yeshivot. It is up to us, administrators and educators, to understand the nature of the problem and to intervene for the sake of our students, their families, and the Jewish people. Coming as I do from both the world of psychology and Jewish education, it is clear to me that on the issue of substance abuse, Jewish educators must look to mental health professionals for information, guidance, and support. Today at this conference, we get the opportunity to do so. I would like to introduce Yona Pollack. Yona Pollack is a licensed addiction counselor and therapist. He has served as the assistant director of Nachas Ruach, the Fred Stark Institute for Drug Rehabilitation and Lifestyle Change in Jerusalem. In his private practice, he has counseled hundreds of yeshiva and seminary students, their parents, rebbeim, and teachers regarding issues of substance abuse. He has participated in numerous workshops and conferences in Israel and abroad on the topic. Yona Pollack.
First, I'd like to thank Atid and all the people that are involved with Atid, Rabbi Bravender, and particularly Rabbi Sachs, who I've had a chance of getting to know and working with, for inviting me to this extremely important conference. The issue of substance abuse, students at risk, and how it affects our yeshiva today is probably, in my opinion, the single most important challenge that that the FUM world has to deal with. To actually have an opportunity where we can discuss this, all of us together in one facility. For that to be facilitated and brought about by Rabbi Sachs and Atid, I'm very, very grateful for, and I'm glad to be able to participate to whatever small extent I might be able to help in this process. If I were to tell all of you that there's no speaking, all the speakers are leaving, all the presentation material we're putting away, and all we're going to do is eat dinner and schmooze a little bit, in my opinion, that would make this an extremely successful event. Aside from the talking, and aside from the learning, and the interfacing, and the sharing, and all the rest of that stuff, just the fact that we're all sitting here together, and we're going to get to know each other a little bit, and we're going to walk out of here with maybe a little bit more contact, I think is probably the most important part of this entire Yom Iyun. After all, we are each other's resources. We are one system. I work with many different yeshivot, many different rebbeim, different individuals, different programs. And I don't see it as all different programs. I see it as one program, like a hospital. A hospital has 10 different floors and 50 different doctors. And if one doesn't know that the other exists, then the goal can't be accomplished. And in my opinion, people that work in this field, whether it's professionally, whether it's in terms of chinuch, are all doing this lishma. And therefore, we need to be aware of each other, and we need to be able to work together. Okay, before we can talk about substance abuse in yeshiva, we have to understand a little bit about what substance abuse is. So I'm going to do the impossible, but I'm used to doing the impossible in the work I do anyway. You should see some of the kids that they drag into me. So you want to fix them, right? But I'll try again here. And what I'm going to do is try to do a quick crash course in the basics of substance abuse, which, believe it or not, with Rabbi Sachs' help and this wonderful material that he presented, I think we can actually do it. All right, so. First, I ask each of you to get this packet out, because we're going to go through it. Okay? You eat later, you work now. Okay. Now, first of all, substance abuse
chemical dependency, addiction. You heard all the terms. They're pretty much the same thing. Okay? Substance abuse basically is an inability to control the use of any mind or mood altering substance, regardless of consequences. Addiction, there are many different definitions for addiction, but the one that I like that basically comes from the World Health Organization, is that addiction is a reoccurring pathological relationship with a person, thing, or event with life-damaging consequences. Now, if you want to write that down, you can. I'm going to go through it again, and I'm going to ask you a question on it. Addiction is a reoccurring pathological relationship with a person, thing, or event with life-damaging consequences. Now, who would like to volunteer what they think is the most critical word in that sentence that describes what addiction is? Pardon? No. You must be a professional. Relationship is correct, and usually it's not gotten until about the third or fourth try. Usually they'll say life-threatening, they'll say reoccurring, pathological, consequences, everything but relationship. And it's very important because addiction is about a relationship that's established with the substance. It's not about the substance. Okay? There's alcohol, which is legal, which is used wonderfully by most of the population. No addiction there. So addiction isn't about alcohol. Addiction is about the use one has with alcohol and other substances. Okay. When we're talking about addiction, it's technically considered a disease. It's an illness. It is characterized by denial, rationalization, manipulation, justification, all that kind of stuff. It does respond to treatment, and there are many different forms of treatment. It is progressive, incurable, and fatal, which means that you can't get rid of the addiction. You can allow the person to live a good life, but you can't take someone who's an alcoholic and make them not an alcoholic. It doesn't happen. The basic different forms of treatment for it is anywhere from outpatient counseling to residential rehab to long-term therapeutic communities. Every one of these treatments is designed for a specific type of client at a specific time in his process. Basically, when you're talking about addiction, classical addiction, the only way to really successfully treat it is through complete abstinence. Complete abstinence means no taking at all of that substance and any other mind and mood altering substances, which means that if a person that classically has an addiction to, let's say, marijuana, he can't use any drugs, including alcohol, ever, for the rest of his life, one day at a time. That's the way it's done. Okay. Now, let me give you some quick statistics just so you get some kind of idea of what I'm talking about, because somebody told me that if you don't get statistics at these kinds of things, then you don't really qualify as really haven't done anything. So I got to do a little bit of that. First, I'm going to just talk basically about marijuana, because that's the substance that most, you know, yeshivas, you know, are, I'd say, that are dealing with this issue. They're dealing primarily with that, at least to start with. And I'm going to, not talking now in the film world, but just generally speaking, 50 million Americans have tried marijuana at least once. That's 20% of the American population. Okay? Marijuana today is about roughly 10 times as strong as it was years ago. So we're talking about a much more powerful substance. One-third of all the people who have used marijuana even one time have gone on to some period of daily use in their life. Some period. 80% of all college students have tried it at least once. Okay. When we're dealing with educators, and Rebellion, which I imagine most of the people here are involved in that area, you all are what I call on the front lines, whether it's outreach professionals or people in yeshivas, you're all on the front lines. You're the first contact that many of these kids are going to have in terms of being able to know whether or not there's a problem. And how do you know if there's a problem? Well, we can easily say, kid smoked up one time, there's a problem. Addict, rehab. That's not going to work very well. And if we do that, our yeshivas are not going to have any kids in them, which isn't going to work very well. So, in order to understand that a little better, that's where this material comes in handy. So, I'm going to encourage everyone to go home and read this. Most of you won't. That's just the way we are. So therefore, I'm going to take you through it very quickly. Because once you've seen it once, and you understand that it's what we call user-friendly, then I think you have a tendency to look at it a little bit further. Just go into the first page that says common drug symptoms of abuse. Okay? Take your pen out, because I want you to just do something, make a quick amendment here. Find alcohol, which is second from the bottom, put a 1 there. Marijuana at the top, put a 2. That page is over here. Some of you, I see, are not on it. Okay, good. All right. Number 3, depressants, 3A. 3B, stimulants. 3C, inhalants at the bottom. 4, hallucinogens. In that category, we could throw ecstasy in as well, though it's not technically a hallucinogen. 5, cocaine. And 6, narcotics. Now, we use the number system. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The higher the number, the worse the problem, basically. Okay? Substance abuse is progressive. Whether we're talking about full-blown addiction or we're just talking about, you know, a kid experimenting or involving himself, usually it's going to start with alcohol, it's going to go to marijuana, and then it's going to move through the different phases. So it's important to know that. Of course, before we even get there, we have 2 drugs that many of us use that I haven't mentioned. Nicotine and caffeine. Okay, but we'll leave those alone. I won't have anybody left in the room. Okay, now, move on a little bit. Next, you're going to see the sheet says facts about drugs. All right? It takes about maybe 3 minutes to read. It's good because it gives you just a basic idea of what we're talking about. Okay. Next, 4 basic stages of alcohol and other drug use. Okay? This is very important. I want you to keep your pen out. Stage 1, I want you to write experimental. Stage 2, recreational. Stage 3, abusive. And stage 4, dependent. What this tells you is that there are different stages of usage, different progressions. Okay? You've got to know when you're looking at a kid or talking to a kid where he's at. If he tells you certain stuff that is stage 4, that's very different than stage 1. And you have to have an idea of that. It's not all the same thing. Okay? Good. All right. Now, next on the back of that page, there's some quick signs of drug abuse. Right? Sudden changes in mood, attitude, vocabulary, things of this sort. It's good to just get an idea of that. Because once again, you all are the people that are going to determine whether this kid ever gets evaluated professionally or not, and that's an important decision that you got to make. And you can't just take every single kid and throw them in for professional evaluations. It's not realistic. However, If you don't get a kid evaluated that needs evaluation, you can have a real serious problem on your hands. Okay, next. Page 6, delusional thinking about addiction. All right. This basically gives you some of the resistance, some of the defenses that the kids are going to tell you when you start talking to them. Right? I'm not a junkie. I can stop whenever I want. I only take this because it's prescribed for me. When you hear this stuff, your ears should light up. To the degree they say there's no problem, that's the exact degree there's a problem. Okay? So it's good to just know that. And this gives you a couple of pages on, you know, how to deal with that, how to understand that, what that means. Okay? Very good. All right, next. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard of the 12-step programs, Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. All right, I've included over here just the first page is the 12 traditions, which is how these programs work. And on the back of that, which is really more important, is the 12 steps, which is the basic idea of what these programs are. Right? They're free. They're non-professional. They're open to anybody. They're available here in Israel. Most of them are in English. There are English meetings of these programs. For any of you that want to know more about it, you can either contact me or usually in the In Jerusalem section of the Jerusalem Post, they give listings of all these meetings. Okay? They interface very well with Orthodox Judaism because they promote finding some kind of a quote-unquote higher power and then going through a spiritual change. In order to make the change you have to make in order to recover. Okay? Good. I want you to skip the page that says, am I an addict? And I want you to go to the next one that symptoms of chemical dependency. Right. These are the signs that when you talk to a kid you're going to hear. Loss of control, blackouts, increased tolerance, needing more of the substance to get the same effect. Using mood-altering drugs as medicine. People will say, it helps me. I just feel better. I'm not an addict. It relaxes me. That's important because the kid actually might need medication to relax him. But I always tell kids, if you want to take medication to relax, why limit yourself to 10 or 12 substances? Why not hire a professional, right? And whose whole job is to go ahead and prescribe medication, the right kind of medication. As a matter of fact, we have one of those over here that I'll probably tell you, this is the right medication, as opposed to that being the right medication. Okay, so it's important to understand what some of these signs, what some of these symptoms are. You look at the back, hurried ingestion, preoccupation with chemical use. Because these things are, once again, going to tip you all off in order to help us and yourselves help the kids. Okay? Now I want to go back to this page that we skipped, which is the Am I an Addict page. Okay. Now, what I like about this okay, page 12. What I like about this isn't in terms to actually determine whether the kid has a problem by out of 29, if you get 15, then you need to go to rehab, and if you get 10, you're not so bad. But I like it because the way to use it, and this is a tool that you all can walk out of here with in your hand. And I hold that these kinds of conferences, you got to give somebody something to walk away with besides some nice, you know, materials and a good meal. Therefore, the way to use it is as follows. First of all, through establishing a relationship with a kid, a confidential or safe relationship, which we'll talk about in a couple of minutes, the object is to try and then find out information through talking, through this relationship, through utilizing it to understand a little bit where this kid is at. And one of the things we'll want to know is a history, not a formal history in terms of the way your relationships are. My relationship is more of a formal history, so that we can understand what's going on here. Once you've gotten that, and you know a little bit about the progression of the kid through the different numbers of using, number 1, alcohol to number 6, and things of that sort, Then you can sit down and you can do this MI-NAS with them and ask them all these questions. And actually give them a copy, if you want, or do it off the record, and check the answers. Then, when you've got all of them, you can say to them, you know, every no answer that you checked, that's not the right answer. And the kid will look at you and say, what do you mean? It says, did I ever do this? No, I never did that. No. And you play with them a little bit. You say, well, it's not really the right. And you go through the thing. And now, you know, he knows that, you know, it's not kosher, right? And then you sit down and you say to him, well, given the choice of yes or no, what's the right answer? You chose no, you didn't do it. Or yes, you did it. But if there was another column, yes, no, and something else, then that would be a better answer for every one of these. And he'll say, well, what would that column say? And you say, that column would say, not yet. Not yet. And then you take him through the questions again. And you say, well, did you ever do? No, I never do this. But I'm telling you the answer isn't no, the answer is not yet. But I'm never going to do that, Yonah. I'll never do that. I'll never do this. I'll never do that. And by having his history there, you can say to him, but let me ask you something. You started smoking marijuana at age 15? At 13, did you ever think you would do it? Say no. At 15, did you ever think you would get into it for a year straight, which you did? He'll say no. But you did, didn't you? Say yeah. And before you ever tried ecstasy, did you ever think you would ever take ecstasy? No. But you did, didn't you? Did you ever think you'd be talking to someone like me? No, but you are, aren't you? And this is usually, in my experience, the first time that you're able to touch on this kid's denial a little bit. Because there's no way out. In other words, you put him in a situation, and he's got to look at it now. And that's a good tool to help you get kids into some kind of process. Okay? All right. Now we can put this stuff away. I call that idea, by the way, the yet. Haven't done it yet. Okay, now. So, right about now you're probably going to say, okay, so I got my crash course, but what does this have to do with us? And we're Jewish. And from. So, Lou, what are we talking about? Feed us and let us go home. Okay. Well, we're not safe. And no, Shikr is not a goy. And we have our own denial problems in the Jewish community, which the addict has in his own way as well. Unfortunately, the disease of addiction or substance abuse doesn't respond the way the Makos did in the tribe. It doesn't respect Pesach. It doesn't skip over Jewish homes. Right? The Makos Bechoros, and we were lucky enough that we had blood to put on our doors and it knew to leave us alone. We don't have blood to put on our doors today to stop this from affecting us. The closest we have is a Torah lifestyle, things of that sort, but that has been and is being permeated through the times we live in, what's happening in the States, and we're a byproduct of the States as well, through the media, through all these different things. But we're not isolated the way we were. Diseases don't discriminate. They don't respect race, they don't respect religion, they don't respect financial brackets. So, that's why we're here. Because it does affect us. Okay, now. Okay, Yonah, fine, so you convinced me. It affects us. But to what extent? So, what's the big deal? A kid here, a kid there. So now we go back to statistics again. You can't get away from statistics, no matter how much you try. All right, so first, Jewish Observer. Most of you are familiar with this. There's a lot of material in this handout that was printed up, copied from here. 50,000 copies of this magazine was sold. That's unheard of. Doesn't happen. Okay. U.S. News and World Report, March. Many of you are familiar with that as well. All right. This article here, Moshe Feiner, Olav Shalom, was in Eretz Yisrael for a time. Son of a Hasid, heroin overdose. You wouldn't have seen that years ago. I attended a conference in New York a couple of months ago, Ohel Nefesh conference, 90 film professionals together in one facility. Second annual conference of this sort, for one purpose only, to produce this. This is a manual made by Jewish firm mental health professionals for our yeshivas, for our professionals, in order to deal with kids in crisis, kids off the derrick, and kids involved with substance abuse. The second conference that I went to was the purpose of updating this. And this document, which is about, 25 pages, is now going to be 50. And this is really a manual on how to deal with this problem. You don't make manuals if there's no problem. Okay? This kind of a workshop that we're doing now, this is the third one of these in 6 years. I was fortunate to have done the first two when I was involved in Nakatruak. Both of those Dr. Tversky was available for. This is the third one. The attendance at this one is about 5 times the others. Okay. This coming May, matter of fact, about 10 days from now, there's going to be a conference in New York. 2-day conference workshop, adolescent substance abuse. For this, specifically for this purpose, Dr. Tversky and Ben-Zion Tversky, his son, and all the American professionals are going to be there. JACS, which is Jewish Alcoholic Chemically Dependent Significant Others. It's a nonprofit support group for Jews and their families and significant others involved with addictions. Did research that said that 10 to 12% of the Jewish world is affected by alcohol and substance abuse. Now we're talking Jewish world, not film world. But still, those numbers are the same in the secular world about. They're about similar. Okay. The article in the U.S. News and World Report states that about 1,500 Orthodox kids in Brooklyn are involved in substance abuse, dealing, stealing around it, and another 2,000 are at risk, and that's only Brooklyn. And that drug-related offenses, crimes, and things like that have gone up 50% in areas like Brooklyn, Borough Park, et cetera. And probably one of the most important signs that there's a problem, and it's a big problem, is that there now is a project underway in New York to open up the first major large-scale Jewish rehab for adolescents, which is going to be somewhere around a $12 million facility. Most of it's going to be raised through private donations from the Jewish community. You don't put out $12 million on a rehab if there's not a problem. Okay? Now, so now we know what substance abuse is. Now we know it affects us. Now we know there's a problem. Okay? What's it got to do with our yeshiva? Okay. Our yeshivas are basically byproducts of the states. We get what comes off of their production lines. And the products they're producing today aren't as Kodesh as they were years ago. Things like assimilation, opulence, media involvement, internet, moral decay, all these kinds of things have resulted in many kids that have come over here and go to our yeshiva have been exposed to some degree. Now we combine with that the fertilization ground of Eretz Israel. Freedom for the first time, extended time, not 1 week away, but months at a time. The kid doesn't go home throughout the year, almost 9 months. No real responsibility in terms of job or performance. You know, even in the tighter miskerot, there's still, you know, freedom and room. Ben Yehuda, alcohol easily available, no real restriction on it, access to the opposite sex in a different way than what was available at home, Shabbos drinking, Purim, Simchas Torah, acceptable. L'chaim, the Rebbe's Tish. We're dealing with a difficult population. Our yeshivas, we're dealing with a very difficult population. And this presents a real challenge. And in order to meet that challenge, I hold that we, as a community, have to be more creative. We can't just sentence a kid to rehab. We have to be able to deal with them in different ways and different forms. Not much full-blown addiction in terms of what we see here with the kids that are coming. We're not talking usually about addicts. Okay? Some of the kids turn out throughout the time to really go that route. The queer thing is that we don't know who's going to go where. Most of the time they're coming not with level 4, 5, and 6 usage. It's usually more alcohol, marijuana, some ecstasy, or LSD. But that's where they come. And now they get the fertilization of Eretz Yisrael. When we talk about applying these kids to the 12-step model, it's too strong for them. It's a very effective model. It works. But it's based upon a person realizing that he's hit bottom, that his life is unmanageable. You try to take a 17-year-old kid who's here for a year telling his life's unmanageable. He's going to laugh at you. What do you mean? What do I got to do? I got no responsibility. I'm showing up. What's the problem? That makes it difficult. You say addict to these kids, they run out the door. And we have to be careful. We have to be careful in how we talk to them, what we do with them. It doesn't mean nothing. It means we have to be more creative, but we have to be involved with them. The thing is how to do that in a way that's going to work. All right. Next we have the problem of the population we're dealing with. Teenagers. These years are very volatile years. They're not emotionally developed to the degree that they will be. They're subject to very quick moves in both directions, down and up. You can have a very quick up move, think everything's fine, 3 months later, down again. So we have to understand that. They don't have the responsibilities and the obligations. Holding them in that grown-ups would have. And a grown-up that will go in a downward spiral might take 10 years to go down to what a kid can do in a year and a half or two. Next we have contributing factors. And this is why we really need to involve professional evaluation. We're dealing with things like ADD, attention deficit disorder, learning disabilities, obsessive compulsive disorder, depression, and oppositional defiant disorder, which are common things that many of these kids have. Sometimes they're self-medicating, there's a lot of low self-esteem, sometimes there's abusive homes. To the degree that this is present, it has to be picked up. Even if we're not talking about an addiction problem or a serious substance abuse problem, it might manifest itself out in first stages, but we have to deal with the depression or the OCD or any of the other things. By getting a kid into a professional that's capable of finding this stuff, then we can put them on the right track. Okay. I want to say something that many people maybe will have a difficult time with, but you know, I believe it. I hear a lot of our yeshivas and a lot of bookos on Eretz Yisrael very much criticized. We give the kids too much freedom. We let them use, we enable them. I think we're doing a very good job, a much better job than we were doing years ago. I think the fact that we're here is an indication of it. It's not an easy problem. Many of these kids are moving through our yeshivas that have some degree of substance abuse and coming out in considerably better shape than when they came in. And it's happening because of this awareness and because there's the involvement that you all understand needs to be done. It's not happening because you're throwing them out and putting them in the rehabs. Don't get me wrong. I'm a big fan of rehabs. I worked in rehabs. But rehabs are for a particular kid at a particular place and time. And if you take a kid who doesn't need rehab, throw him in the rehab, then you're telling him you don't understand him, and he's basically done with you because it's crazy. It doesn't work. So we have to deal with them in a way that's going to work. Okay. Now, one of the benefits of yeshivas is that they deal with the spiritual void. And there is a big spiritual void in this problem, because this problem needs a spiritual solution. And the spiritual solution can be affected very, very well when we've got Torah, Judaism, Eretz Yisrael, and these kinds of people involved in our lives. So, what we need to do is we need to stay with these kids. We need to support them in what they're going through. The professional is going to be able to determine the extent of the problem, how to respond, which approach. He's going to be able to guide, the rebbeim the way they need to be guided and help them work with these kids. Professional is going to be able to pick out who's got the clinical disorders, who doesn't. Professional is going to help you deal with the parents. Okay? Very, very important. Low self-esteem, big issue. Judaism is restrictive. I can't. Full of all I can't. I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this. Tight parameters. It's a sense of right and wrong, very clear in Judaism. Orthodox, you're right or you're wrong. You did this or you didn't do this. And then kids get, I'm bad. I didn't do it. I don't fit in. Problem, big problem. What I like to deal with this, and this is the second tool I'm going to give you, besides that YETS tool, because I think this is very effective in dealing with parents, and since I've only got a couple of minutes left before they whip me out of here, I want to introduce this to you. This is used for dealing with parents that are really very, very rough on your kids, and I give it to kids as well because it helps them to understand a little bit how they ended up in this situation. Now, I'm not saying substance abuse is the parents' fault, but certain dysfunctional relationships and the way that things happen in Orthodox homes sometimes creates problems. So I call this idea the names idea. Everybody has two names. Okay? I'm not talking about Hebrew English. I'm not talking about real name, nickname. I'm talking about first name, last name. Real simple. We have it in secular. So-and-so, Moshe Goldberg. We have it in Funk, Pinkas Benheim. Okay. Let's take a case, theoretical case. Goldberg family lives in Muncie. Father's a doctor, rabbi, mother's on all the Hesed organizations. Well-known family, five kids, and little Moshe, 18. Now, what usually happens a lot is that Moshe Goldberg's parents are doing what I call last name work, Goldberg work. Goldberg, 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 Goldberg. See, these are the way Goldbergs dress, these are the way Goldbergs get married, these are the way Goldbergs learn, these are the yarmulkes Goldbergs wear, these are the shirts Goldbergs wear, Goldberg, Goldberg, Goldberg. Now, is that bad? I don't think that's bad, as long as it's a couple with first name work, with Moshe work. Now, we have to give kids guidance, hinuch, mesoret, structure. We have to. Without that, we haven't done what we're supposed to do. Parents will a lot of times say, I don't care about Moshe. He's got all his life to be Moshe. I got to give him Goldberg stuff now, and he's going to go boo. Well, if you give him too much Goldberg stuff, he's going to go boo. That's the problem. And to the degree that we don't make room for Moshe at home, then that's the degree that he's not going to make room for Goldberg outside of the home. And then we get what I call the Superman Act, where the kid leaves the house and he, Clark Kent, rips off his thing and becomes Superman. And these kids have taken clothes and t-shirts and shorts and put them in plastic bags, bury them outside trees, outside of their house under trees, and go and change into their Moshe identity. We have to give this kid room to do Goldberg Moshe style. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the need of identity, so we can't ignore that. If we don't institute it, then we're going to have a problem. Now, it's a good idea. Everybody buys it. Sounds great. But if you don't support it in Torah, then you haven't really done your job. So we got to support it in Torah.
Okay, we got to support this somewhere. Jewish sources, where do we find the support for this? Okay. We don't find it hidden in a pasuk somewhere in Devarim with a Rashi on it. No, we find it in Tefillah. It's so chashuv that we find it in Shemona Esrei. We say it three times a day. Where in Shemona Esrei? First pasuk. Are you kidding me? First pasuk of Shemona Esrei? It doesn't say that. It says that. What's the first pasuk of Shemona Esrei say? Ruch ata Hashem Elokeinu Velochei Avoteinu. Blessed are you, God, our God, God of our fathers. Then the God of Avram, God of Yitzchak, God of Abraham. Now, we ask the question, why do we need to say God of Abraham, God of our fathers, and our God? Why not just say, blessed are you, God, our God, God of Abraham, God of Yitzchak, God of Yaakov? Or say, blessed are you, God, God of our fathers, God of Abraham, God of Yitzchak, God of Yaakov? Why both? Because the Shemona Esrei realizes that we have two different relationships with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. We have a first name relationship, our God relationship, Elokeinu relationship, a Moshe relationship, a Yarmulke over here relationship, and we have a last name relationship, a God of our fathers, Elokei Avoteinu relationship, a Goldberg relationship. We need both. If it's only our God, then when it stops becoming our God, because whatever reason, the shiksa looks good or the chay food looks good, then we're out because we have nothing holding us here. And if it's God of our fathers, we're not our God, then when we leave our father's home, we don't got no God. And that's the problem. And that's one of the major things that we do in our yeshivot over here, in my opinion, very well, is we give these kids a place to do our God, Moshe relationships. And I think that that's an important concept that we can use, and I think it's an important concept that we do over here without realizing it. And, of course, we've got Jewish sources that is in your material that I want you all to understand, because as Rabbi Shaya Cohn says in his article on the Jewish Observer, in the U.S. News and World Report, nobody ever told these kids drugs isn't kosher. Nobody ever told them. And Rav Moshe Zichron LeBracha clearly says, yes, sir. Completely prohibited. Finished. End of story. Nothing to talk about. So, I encourage you all to look at that and understand that. And the last point that I'm going to make is, it's important to stay with these kids, even if we move them out of yeshivot. There was a whole discussion at this Ohel conference, instead of kicking the kid out, we transfer kids. Find them another place. Because when a kid ends up on the street, that's where trouble comes. And we have the obligation to try and do that. Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. I would now like to introduce Dr. Edwin Goldstein, the respondent. Dr. Edwin Goldstein is an adolescent psychiatrist in private practice for over 30 years in Englewood, New Jersey. He is an assistant clinical professor at Mount Sinai Medical School. Formerly, he has been a psychiatrist with the Clinical Genetics Program at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, as well as the director of the Hawthorne Cedars Knoll School, a residential program for emotionally disturbed and delinquent adolescents. In his private practice, he treats many adolescents from the broad Orthodox community in the New York, New Jersey area. Dr. Goldstein.
I feel like I should start with the anecdote of the blind men and the elephant. It isn't so much that Yonah and I are going to disagree. I think we're going to be describing different aspects of the problem and perhaps reaching somewhat different conclusions. But that's because we're talking about different parts of the problem. It's a very wide problem. I also feel a little bit like, I guess, when Hillel got up to speak after Shammai and was about to say, now I'm going to tell you like it really is. And there's a lot of stuff that's going to overlap. There's a lot of stuff that's perhaps from a slightly different point of view. I think Yonah described very well the 12-step AA program, which is only one part of the action. I think the statistics and the studies have shown that the AA program is very appropriate for about 30% of people. And it has to do with their diagnosis, with the issues that they bring with them to the to the treatment situation. For the other people, it doesn't work. It works very well. It's a superb program for those people who are able to use it. For others, it simply doesn't work. The same thing can be said, may be said, for rehab. Rehab, the percent of recidivism, the number of people who get back on drugs after a rehab program, is enormous. The number of kids who go into rehab programs and who learn more from the experience, you know, they come out more experienced. I've talked to kids on some occasion who feel just terrible. I've got to go into that rehab group meeting, and I haven't done anything terrible this week. How can I show up at the meeting without saying all the awful stuff I've done, all the stuff I've stolen, all the sexual activity, what have you, which is that which is going to gain them the respect and the admiration of the individuals in the peer group. Similarly, up and down the line, I think that one needs to understand, and I think that Yonah touched on it, you know, the precursors of drug involvement, and we've talked about all different kinds of drug involvement. There's experimentation, there are people who are more heavily involved, and there are people who are physically addicted. There are the precursors of it, I think, are the essence for this kind of a program that we're talking about. I don't think the purpose of this conference would be to turn all of our expert and committed teachers into drug counselors, but it's to increase their sensitivity and awareness to those issues which go into a kid becoming involved with drugs in any degree whatsoever. Worse yet, whereas in the world at large, when a kid gets involved with drugs, there's easy access to go back home. When you're expelled from the Orthodox community, the rope, unless we're careful, the cords are cut, the relationships are destroyed, and that's exactly what I think the teachers and the principals and the educators need to be aware of. There are all kinds of statistics that are involved in this. Take heroin, for example. Heroin, the average length of time, let me start that sentence over again. Most people who get involved with heroin, to any extent, including addiction, are off the drug spontaneously without help within 2 years. That figure is close to 80%, depending which statistics you read. The problem arises with the accumulative 20% that continues to grow and grow and grow. But the basic issue is we have to be able to keep the doors open to maintain the Jewish connection, the Orthodox Jewish connection, throughout the time that the individual is troubled, and to be there and to be there for them to get them back into the community. I'm sure all of us are aware of solid citizen, terrific parents, rabbanim, all kinds of families whose kids have gone off in some direction, which often, more often than I think we've been aware of, includes drug usage of all sorts. And then if they're patient and if the family deals with it and is willing to work on the issues, the youngster comes back. The youngster comes back, and it's almost miraculous. What you do with the 20% that remain is a different issue than what we have to do to be available for those kids who need our help. The basic issue, if we follow the non-Orthodox model, and we have to talk about the Orthodox model as a separate issue. If we follow the non-Orthodox model, the single largest number of drug-involved kids come from families where there's alcohol involvement, where one or both of the parents have been alcohol involved, and the same is true about drug usage involved. When the parents have used drugs openly, then the likelihood of the kids becoming drug involved is far higher than under other circumstances. Now, somebody is going to say that that's not the Orthodox Jewish problem, but I'm afraid that it is. I think to a greater extent than we like to believe, these problems have been around for a long time, including closet alcoholism in Jewish families, people who drink too much, people who have their first schnapps each and every morning, a couple of times with a kiddush each morning or something to that effect. The problem is also not new. We just need to quote one of the sedras recently, to indicate that the problem has been in the Jewish world for a long time. Vayomer Hashem al Aaron lemor, Yayin v'shechar al teish tatov v'necha itach b'vachem elohim oed v'lo tamutu chukat olam l'dorotechem. That goes back a long way and is clearly reflective, no matter how you explain that pasuk or what's going on with Nadav v'Avihu. There's clearly a reflection of some drinking issue, and there are other issues, medrashim of all sorts, which when you look at them in any detail, there's been more or less a degree of alcohol problem. One of the earliest cases I remember, 25 years ago, a call in the middle of the night from a Hasidic family in one of the firm neighborhoods in the greater New York area, where it turns out they had their 20-year-old son chained to the bed while they were feeding his heroin addiction, because they didn't have the foggiest idea what to do with it. The notion that we're talking only about marijuana is not correct. We're talking about all kinds of drugs. We're talking about heroin. We're talking about hallucinogens. We're talking about mescaline. We're talking about LSD. We are talking about ecstasy, cocaine. Okay, it is a major problem. One of the frustrating parts of being a psychiatrist in private practice is that the roles get reversed. You get a call from a yeshiva, and I don't mean a day school. I mean a yeshiva, any kind of yeshiva, the whole spectrum of yeshiva. And they have a kid whom they suspect is on drugs. And we evaluate, and true enough, kid's on drugs. The first thing that they do is throw the kid out. And suddenly, the roles are reversed. I'm negotiating with them, arguing with them, pleading with them. How can we afford to throw away Jewish kids? You know, these kids tend to be from terrific Jewish families. The Hasidic kid chained to the bed was a very caring, warm family who just didn't have the foggiest idea how to deal with this particular problem. The result in that instance was terrific. I'm not saying that it's always going to be terrific, but the part of the problem within the Jewish community is secrecy. It's secrecy. You don't talk about it. If you have a problem, you don't talk about it. It's going to affect your child's shidduch. You know, you won't be able, if there's somebody in the family with a problem, and you see all kinds of things out there. I've seen families where there's somebody locked in the attic whenever they have a particular episode, a particular related kind of episode. So nobody even knew that there was anybody up in the attic. And it sounds funny, but it's a reflection of how the community deals with secrecy and deals with the problem of opening up to people on the outside. And that's where I think you people, the educators, are the first line of defense. And again, not as drug counselors, but as teachers, as rabbeim, as those are the people on the front line. And again, to look at the non-orthodox model, what are the issues? The issues are the issues that you have, that we have, you have always been hearing about all along. Okay, start from the top. Kids who have experienced physical abuse, sexual abuse, psychological abuse, those are the kids. When you study the drug populations, those factors appear far more often than in the general population. You talk to kids who have go down the whole list, economic deprivation, kids who have broken homes. And these are among us, these are not out of the Orthodox world. The people we're talking about, once upon a time, I think the Orthodox world had the luxury of thinking these are a few deviant individuals, we'll throw them out of the community, send them Yichutz L'machaneh, and then the rest of us will be safe. That is simply not the case. The individuals who are involved in this epidemic are people just like everybody else in this room. They are good people, they're well-meaning people, they're people under stress, they're people who have all kinds of problems, and they don't know how to deal with them, and as a result, the kid suffers. Worse yet, we have kids, as Yonah mentioned, kids with learning disabilities, kids with attention deficit disorders, but these are kids who feel themselves to be non-achievers, kids who believe themselves they can't make it in the community, particularly in some of the more from yeshivot, where they're expected to learn all day long, and you run into kids who can't read, and what does a kid do when everybody else in their circle is doing well and is achieving, and they just can't make it, and nobody is even tuned in to their particular problem, and they don't do anything. They find some way of achieving notoriety, of achieving the respect of their peer group. It's the same in the public school education. If a kid is flunking out of school, those are the kids who start dating earlier, who get more involved with drugs earlier, who drop out of school. If nobody is tuned into their agony, then they've got to find some way to make themselves special and different. There's another level here, and then Yona mentioned that frequently the adolescents whom you see who are drug involved have ups and downs all over the place. The jargon word is comorbidity. Worse yet, God has blessed the Ashkenazi Jewish population with certain genetic disorders, that they have more genetic disorders of those varieties than other groups do. One of them is familial depressions, is bipolar reactions. All of these are turning out to be additional Jewish genetic disorders. It's a factor that we need to be aware of, tucked into the back of your head. Okay, and these kids, the numbers of individuals with these diagnoses, and they're all over our yeshivot, and they're all over our firm communities. I know because you see them in the office. They're all over the place. They are more susceptible to self-medication, to using drugs, that when they're depressed, they want the uppers to get out of the depression. When they're all sorts of varieties of that sort. And up until this point, the Jewish community has been very reluctant to come out and deal with these problems. I think that's getting better. Maybe I'm deluding myself. Okay? 5 minutes? Okay. I'll take six. I think it's becoming easier. And I think part of the way, I think that the Frim community has to understand that good mental health treatment does not involve ripping the kid away from their from backgrounds or their from roots. It doesn't do anything of that sort. And it doesn't mean that if somebody is from this segment of the Orthodox community that you're going to convert the patient to that segment. It doesn't work that way. That would be terrible psychiatric care. You need to be able to deal with the individual in terms of their own alienation from their own community. Alienation is what drives these kids away. If they feel themselves to be not part of that that's what it works. They're fine in terms of the religious practice is concerned, usually, but suddenly when they run into a brick wall and they feel rejected in the absence of friends, in the absence of an appropriate peer group, that's when they find all these other ways. This isn't for me. Suddenly they find the irrationalities or this doesn't make any sense or the inconsistencies. And one has to deal with them within the community, within whatever their shita is, in terms of why are you feeling this alienation? What is this alienation all about? An enormous number of times, again, that's the wise, the blind man and the elephant, an enormous number of times, the drug problems that might come through my office, enormous family histories. And if you deal with the family history, you will ultimately impact on what's going on for the kid. But it ain't easy. It is certainly not easy, There are many, many factors that go into this. I think the final word I would like to mention is the extremely frustrating part that comes when the principal or the Rebbe, for whatever the reasons are, says, get this kid out of here. This kid is going to contaminate my otherwise beautiful program. I think that the key issue that ought to come out of this sort of meeting is the heightening sensitivity of educators and those involved with children as to the early symptoms. Let's not wait until we're talking heroin addiction or marijuana habituation. Marijuana is habituating, not addicting. Earlier on, to be able to recognize and to be able to provide the special Rebbe, the special teacher, the special caring, to recognize that this is a child at risk, because we can't afford to continue to lose Jewish children. And that's what the programs up until now have been doing, is throwing out Jewish children. And then you see them on the street. We can talk about the... And none of these problems are new. Anybody knows from Brooklyn? You've heard of the Avenue J Boys? No, that nobody's heard about the. Nobody's from Brooklyn. Okay, the Avenue J Boys is a major institution in Brooklyn. The yeshiva boys dressed like yeshiva boys, who sell drugs on Avenue J, and everybody knows where they exist and that they exist, but everybody sort of ignores their existence. I once had a Shiloh quotation marks. Whether a girl could go out on a shidduch date with a boy who was a member of the Avenue J Boys. So these problems are not new, and they need to be explored, and you guys are on the front line. The mental health people are not on the front line. There needs to be a lot of back and forth consultation about those issues.
Okay, now I'd like to invite you to ask questions, and when you do ask your question, please identify yourself and where you are from.
Because we're recording this professionally, there's a microphone there and there's a microphone here which can go about the audience.
Hi. It's sort of a question, sort of a point of information. My name is Chezi Goldberg, and I work with... Right. I'm from the Goldberg family from Munster. No relation. I work with kids on the streets here in Israel, and I also write in the Jewish press about it, and have a radio show on Eretz Sheva. And I'm a little surprised about one thing. I thought I was coming here today to talk about addictions with kids in our schools here in Israel, and if I would walk out not knowing anything coming into this conference, I think it was an American problem. We're denying it again. There are schools in Jerusalem, from schools, elementary school kids, junior high school kids, are using and dealing drugs. Why are we talking about Brooklyn? Why are we talking about America? Priority One's doing that. OHEL's doing that. We have to realize it's happening in all of our yeshivas and seminaries here. You can go there any night to Ben Yehuda and see girls from Beis Yaakov turning tricks. The same thing happened with girls from the Mamad schools. There's Mamad schools who've gone through situations where kids are getting drugs in elementary school. And I would like that to be one of the things coming out of the conference today, that we model what they're doing in America and admitting that there's a problem there and focus on it here. It's not just the kids coming overseas for 1 year.
You won.
Yes.
My name is Dr. Delvin. I'm
Stop him, without short of being a policeman. Hi. Short of being a policeman, I'm not quite sure of what you really expect us to do. We're not trained psychologists. Yep.
even if we were, transit college cannot stand in someone's head, can't deal with their problems. We're not able to deal with their families, which are anywhere between 200 miles to 8,000 miles, wherever they are. And there's a real serious problem here. Somebody telling us, don't throw the child away. There's no real school that's set up, certainly on the girls' side, I'm not so sure of the boys' side, which can really handle kids of this nature in such a way we don't throw them out. I can answer.
I think that, well, first of all, we have to stop starting the questions with the word hi.
Bye.
Try shalom or something. The issue is, by the time you're faced with that dilemma, it's far along in the game. I think that there needs to be a lot of sensitivity training before you get to that point. I'm talking about simpler cases. 20 years ago, called to see a kid. Instantly, they heard the word marijuana. The kid was thrown out of his school, a very reputable yeshiva. In order to provide material for today, I guess, just before I left for Israel, for Pesach, a kid from a very firm girls' school, enormously troubled family, delightful young girl, was found to have a marijuana cigarette. Her principal greeted her with, if we get any real evidence that you're involved with marijuana, we're going to throw you out immediately. Now, that's inappropriate. They need to have somebody who puts an arm around the girl's shoulder and who talks with her and recognizes her agony, and we're going to help you through this. And this is a kid who's in enormous turmoil. We're throwing her away. We are going to throw her away. I recognize the administrative need. I recognize that the principal needs to know exactly where his peer culture is and what the makeup of the group is. And you can't have a group which is 100% drug involved. But you need to be able to, there needs to be somebody who to see what you can do to form a relationship with this kid, with these children, with these adolescents, so that it's possible to keep them met. They're not so different from the rest of us. They're not so different from our children. They're not so different from our relatives. A bit of bad luck, a bit of bad genetics, a bit of who knows what that goes into their predicament, and we're losing numbers, and we're no longer talking small numbers. There are no good statistics of the level of the problem in the Orthodox community. The best ridiculous guess is about 12 to 15% of the schools are drug involved, whatever that means. There are no good statistics because everybody lies about it. But nobody is open enough to tell you this is the problem and let's deal with it as a group. Nobody is willing to do that. I agree with you that it's hard to do that. It's difficult to deal with the parents. But this is something that, very strangely, usually it's the other way, that the principal wants to keep the kids. The psychiatrist said the kid is too who knows what. Literally, with so many principals, I have to find a reason to keep the kid. I'm not talking about who knows what, Dillinger, or somebody who's Murder Incorporated, or somebody who's really going to contaminate. I'm talking about Rachmona's kids, kids who need our help. Yes?
Absolutely. That's not the issue. Once she deals with that, we have dealt with it, we'll probably
deal with the people.
The
problem is when
we
have children
come in, and we find very often a couple of J Street, Jay Avenue, we have ways of suitcases come in, all set, prepared. Like that.
We're not
going to
win them all. I'm not
going to win them. How do you suggest we deal with that? And even once we're called a middle problem, which I see the major issue, if you start from your finger and then even from one shoulder, how without here it doesn't work. Classic problem Judaism, okay? And if you try
to do it without
year, you don't use the year up. You have a problem, you use the year up, and the child has the worst self-esteem problem.
I think you're describing the issue, but it needs to be, there needs to be a ground, there needs to be a new sensitivity. And I think it works. I think it's doable. I mean, it isn't that in the office we're doing some fantastic kind of, we're relating to the kids. We're relating to the kids. I think part of the issue in the psychiatry, first you have to get the, who knows what, you have to get the confidence of the principal and the rabbi that you're on the same team. You know, it's not always easy in the psychiatric office.
you have to work hard to get the hechsher of some central rabbi or some central group so that the rabbi knows that you're okay and you're not going to be doing anything damaging to his program. But over the years, one is able to do that. But you're stating an excellent problem. I don't pretend there's an easy answer. That's worth a lengthy discussion as to how to proceed to deal with it. But it's dealable. With many, many instances, it's dealable. We're still dealing with the middle group. We're not dealing with the physically, chemically addictive part. Although, in the public school studies, I mean, the non-orthodox group studies, the kids who sell drugs are in a different category from kids who even... That's a far more advanced involvement in drugs and much more difficult to deal with. These are just coincidences, you know, things that work together. There are so many different components to this. One needs to develop different strategies for different subgroups, just like Yona has the AA component, the 12-step component, that's for a certain kind of kid. We need strategies for all of these kids, and we also need to have a lot of family involvement.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can get on the record here, but I just wanted to make a couple of comments. First, on your Heskel's point, I think it's an excellent point. Unfortunately, it's not my area, and I can't talk intelligently about it because I specialize in the English-speaking population. I do deal with some of the younger youth that does live here, but I don't think that's going to answer your question, but I think it's an excellent point. And maybe if there's someone here that does deal a little bit in that population, they can make some comments on that. Secondly, what was raised over here, first of all, as I said earlier, we are one system, and there are specialty programs that exist within Israel, men and women, that does deal with different elements of this population. We don't have programs that deal with, you know, kids that are full-blown addicts and that just let kids use all day long. But we have programs that are a little bit more tolerant and that have more professional involvement, that have more of a band, that have a higher staff ratio to its students, and that work more closely with professionals that even use sometimes a combination of drug testing and other things of that sort when necessary in order to deal with this population. So I don't think the answer is ignore it and leave them in his system so that the one bad kid ruins 70 good kids. I don't think it's throw them out and put them into rehab. I think there's fine places in the system that does work. That's why we need to encourage programs that are dealing with different elements, not just mainstream, and there's been a lot of that happening lately. There's been more development of specific programs to deal with marginal kids or kids that are more on the edge or things of that sort. Another point I want to make is it was pointed out in the conference that I attended in the States that removing a kid from a yeshiva, even if it's substance abuse, whatever it is, doesn't necessarily eliminate the risk to that yeshiva or to those other kids. That kid is still there, he's still in the community, and he still has access. So we just have to understand that. Okay.
My name is Benjamin Phillips from the Unity Center. We have a drop-in center for homeless youth.
Hello? That's a drop-in.
That's right.
My name is Benjamin Phillips. I'm from the Anania Youth Drop-In Center, and I just want to confirm what you just said. Two things I really want to point out here. We deal with mostly homeless youth, youth who actually don't have a home, have nowhere to go, sleep in the streets, have drug problems. And I was very much amazed while I was interacting with the youth, how many of these youth actually came on a one-year program or came to study in the yeshiva. And by the time they had a drug problem, they were afraid to talk with their educators about it. They kept it quiet. And unfortunately, because they were not able to come out with the problem, no help was available. And by the time that the problem came to the surface, it was so bad they were thrown out of the yeshiva. And instead of going back to the stage, they first stay with a friend and go and so on and so forth, and they wind up homeless, floating in the streets of Jerusalem. We daily have coming people to our center for free meal counseling and other therapies who started off in Israel as yeshiva people and wind up homeless because they were thrown out. And I hope that the educators in the near future will consider twice by throwing out someone, because you don't only throw them out of the yeshiva, you actually throw them into a life what's even worse. And next to that, as you mentioned before, afterwards, they still go out with the friends of the yeshiva. And they get the kids into trouble because they have an anxiety against yeshiva that's been thrown out. And they go like, you know what, I've got a better place to be. I've got a better environment where you feel better and you can be cooler. So I would just, you know, to all of the educators here say, be careful, because once you throw them out, you throw them in something else which can cause problems to the kid as well as the people they used to study with.
My name is Miriam Reisler, and I'm from Beit Shemesh. I taught in high school before I made Aliyah this year, and one of the problems that is prevalent in girls' high schools is eating disorders, and eating disorder is, I guess, an addiction of a sort. And it's a very seductive addiction to young women who are trying very, very hard to be perfect. And other girls who see a girl with an eating disorder recognize that she's hurting herself, but at the same time, they wish that they had the willpower to pull off that kind of dieting so they could have that flat stomach, that great figure, that supermodel look. So it's a very destructive thing. And yet, when a girl is identified with an eating disorder in a school, she's not thrown out. The approach is definitely one of putting an arm around that student and trying to find a way to help her cope within the context of the school, trying to help find a way to help the other students cope with her eating disorder. I think, though, that one of the differences is that an eating disorder, even as seductive as it is to the other people in the school, it's recognized as something that's that is destructive. And the kids understand that it's a real problem. One of the problems that I've heard, though, when it comes to drug use and alcohol, is that the dangers are not clearly demarcated in the minds of the kids who are getting started with them. If I use marijuana 7 times in the course of my high school experience at a couple of parties that I go to, so. And so I think that what was termed experimental use, the kids sometimes, I think, call it recreational, but let's say it's experimental use, which maybe for us, we should be picking up that this is the first sign of a problem. A, it's very hard to pick it up, but B, I don't think that the kids recognize it as a problem the way they're recognizing eating disorders as a problem. What can we do to articulate the dangers more clearly so that kids won't have the problem of starting, because it's really no problem at all?
Well, it sounds like what you're talking about is called prevention.
Right. I'm not going to say hi, I'm not going to drop in either. It sounds like what you're talking about is called prevention. And when we did this first workshop in this field 6 years ago with Dr. Tversky, he said that prevention is usually not that effective, particularly because you'll say to kids, don't use drugs, and they'll say, why not? What else is there? And if you try to point out the dangers, look at cigarettes. I mean, we can't clearly more point out dangers than anything else that there is. And look, you know, so the whole way the mind works, you know, in terms of rationalization, it won't be me, and it's young, and B, and this, and that, and that one, and that one, it's hard. The way we can do it, though, is through maybe making the only product we do have to offer, which is a Torah lifestyle, and you know, our family environments, and our schools, and our relationships, you know, in those regards, as fulfilling and as healthy as we can make them. Other than sitting down and enumerating all the dangers of substances and things of that sort, eating disorders I agree with you, it's a serious problem. Unfortunately, though, it's not looked at. See, people pay more attention to what's going to hurt other people than what hurts the suffering person. Someone from eating disorder might suffer a lot more than someone from in a certain stage of substance abuse. But because it's not a threat to other people, you know, it's hard to sit down and convince another girl to eat, you know, 20 milkshakes and then blow up, put a finger down the throat. So therefore, unfortunately, that's the way that we tend to look at things. So.
I think one of the things you mentioned is that the staff might not feel that 7 marijuana cigarettes was a lot. So what, you know? There needs to be the staff education. I don't think we can stress that enough. There needs to be someplace, maybe I didn't hear it correctly, I think it's extremely important that the staff be aware that nobody should be permissive. Not being permissive doesn't mean you go around hollering all that. It means you're aware of the fact of where the kids are, and you need to be able to talk to them and relate to them and help them see what the realities are. Prevention is a double-edged sword, because by bringing up the subject, you bring it to some people's attention, and groups have tried it both ways. They try to ignore the problem. That doesn't work. There's got to be a committed staff that is committed to prevention, that is committed to talking to the kids, alerting them to the facts. Sure, you're going to open up problems. Sure, you're going to have the little kid in the back row who feels that he has no status at all. Hey, I might get some status if I take on cigarettes. Marijuana cigarettes. There might be some rabbis, some other faculty members who believe that occasional pot is not so terrible, the kid is still doing well, but in the scheme of things, you need to alert people to the problems. And the problems are multiple, depending on where the kid is coming from and what segment of the population he's in. But if you can't trust your teacher and your Rebbe or whomever, then where are you going to get it from? You're going to get all of your facts out from Ben Yehuda Street and from the other parts of the town, rather than getting it from a committed source. Telling somebody, just offering them a Torah way, that's terrific. But these kids feel rejected by the Torah way, which is the problem, that they feel that the Torah way is not open to them, has not accepted them as they are. And that's part of this enormous alienation that they feel. I think we need to be aware of the kids. The fact that we're talking about them and developing sensitivities to their needs is a step in that direction. And it's extremely important that the staff relate to kids and that the immediate response, I'm going to repeat myself, not be throw the kid out. Throw the kid out is not the solution.
My name is Heshi Grossman. I teach in a yeshiva where none of these anecdotal horror stories apply. We have patience. We don't throw out the kids. We deal with them. They relate to the rabbis. And still, I think you're doing something unfair. There is a basically, you're putting all the burden on the education institutions, and I think that there's one point we're really not capable of dealing with this problem, which means basically take it for what it is. A yeshiva is a yeshiva, and despite the fact that we try to deal with the whole individual and we try to solve his problems, but the bottom line is we're an educational institution and I'm trying to teach them Torah. Now, we're simply in over our heads. It's impossible for the school to do everything that you're demanding that the school handle.
I think there needs to be input from mental health professionals. I'm sorry to talk about the States again, but that's where my experience is. There are more and more yeshivot where the faculty, where the Rebbe, will call me, what should we do? Or send in patients for consultation, not for me to treat, for them to relate to. And that's the way, yes, I completely agree with you that you may be in over your head. And I said initially, I think, that the idea is not to train you to be a drug counselor or to train you to be a mental health person, but how do we approach this kid? What are the strengths? What are the weaknesses? What are the weaknesses? Is this salvageable? Is this kid not salvageable? I'll say it again, because people sometimes think I'm suggesting being permissive. I don't believe in being permissive. I think kids need to know where the rules are, but that has to be administered with a velvet glove and with a lot of warmth and a lot of ahava and a lot of good things. Then it works, and you have to know what's the context of that kid. How does it work for that kid? You're raising a superb question that can't be dealt with in a minute. It's a superb question.
Yeah, the only comment I want to add on that is just we've got to change. the yeshivot have to adjust themselves, staff-wise, to the type of kids that they're getting. And more kids are coming in with different kinds of problems. We have to adjust either the staff, the kinds of people we involve in our staff. We have to open up relationships with other people, professionals, mentors, people of this sort, that are knowledgeable in these areas that can help the yeshivas deal with these problems. If that means that we have to increase funding, if it means we have to have a bigger budget, if it means that we have to let parents know before they send a kid to Israel that they might be putting out, you know, $100, $200 a month for additional help in certain cases, then that's what we need to do. But we're getting a certain kid, and we can't turn back reality, we can't deny reality. We don't want those kids anymore. We want the kinds of kids we used to get 10 years ago. We're getting what we're getting, and we have to deal with what we're getting.
Sure.
Okay. Because our time is limited, what we're going to do now is take a few questions all at once, and we'll let the panel discuss them. David.
It's several issues. I guess all connected. I'll try
who
to.
Who are you, David Katz?
Oh, who I am, David Katz. David Katz from Michlelet Bevaseret. First of all, I think part of the issue that a lot of us are expressing is that although I think we all agree that in the Jewish community at large, and even in the Orthodox Jewish community at large, there's a major problem, a problem that is at much higher proportions than was even 5 years ago and certainly 10 years ago, perhaps in our individual institutions, we're not seeing that percentage. And perhaps if many of us were dealing with institutions where we were dealing with a much higher, you know, if we were dealing with a 20% or 30% or even a 10% ratio of our student body suffering from an acute problem, we couldn't just throw out all our kids. But when you're dealing with an institution of let's say, 100 students, and perhaps you get one every couple years where you have to deal with this, then our attitude is going to be very different than perhaps you, the professionals, who are seeing the Jewish community at large. But that having been said, if in fact that is the reality, then first of all, I think that there's a way to give ahava and still throw the kid out of school at the same time. In other words, if throwing out with love. But what I mean is, with a smile, is that, you know, in other words, and in this case I serve as the minahel of a school, so in other words, if I'm the bad guy and us as an administration of a school are throwing the kid out, we have a wealth of faculty members who, even as we are throwing the child out of school, are then on the other phone getting them into another institution, maintaining a connection. I don't think that we have to be throwing a kid out of school, has to be cutting the cords. In particular, in yeshivot in Israel, I think the American high schools in particular have been putting too much pressure on the year in Israel as if we're the be-all and end-all for this kid. We get the same thing when it comes to admissions. If you don't take this kid, even though he doesn't meet your standards, where is he going to be? You're cutting his cords. The answer is we're only the schools in Israel. In other words, and I could understand perhaps, and maybe it's my perspective, throwing a kid out of high school in New York, where's the kid going to go? He's branded for life. But if the kid doesn't function 7,000 miles away from home, he goes home. There are plenty of kids who don't make it through their year in Israel for all those other contributing factors that you mentioned. And this in fact, you know, may be one of them. So I don't see why the pressure to keep the kid in our system, either by other systems in Israel, we're sending them back to America where their parents who ultimately have to bear the responsibility here, and hopefully even if you're dealing with a semi-dysfunctional family, it's not a completely dysfunctional family, let them deal with it. I don't think the issue is access. I think that's an issue we're all prepared to deal with, limiting access and educating against, you know, the things in the society that we want to protect them from. The issue is when you've got a kid with a substance abuse problem or any other behavioral problem, and it's affecting that roommate, it's affecting that entire close circle who will suddenly become the mommy and daddies for this kid immediately. It can pull down the atmosphere in an entire school, and it's not just the kid versus it really can have a negative impact on an entire year, and I think therefore we as administrators, unlike teachers, have to be able to deal with that. Last comment just regarding the eating disorders. Our attitude in school is always to try to work with eating disorders, but I do know that there's a wealth of people out there, professionals, who are of the opinion send them right home. And I have sometimes been accused of being too dangerous with eating disorders because there are professionals who say throw them home, so I don't know if it's as black and white as it is. And if I had a kid with an eating disorder who was disruptive in school, like often the kid with the substance abuse problem, it's not just the substance abuse, it's manifesting his attendance, his behavior, so I'd have to get rid of the girl with the eating disorder also, not because of the disorder for the disorder, but because of the behavior that surrounds it. So I think it's really one big issue, it's just the question of the behavior. Right.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. A question right over here, and then we're going to take one more, and then we'll let the respondents.
Yes, that's what I do.
Sure. I'm Izzy Fogel. I'm here from visiting for the Chagim, my children from New Haven, Connecticut. I am a board member of JAGS back in the States, and I heard this conference was taking place, so I took the liberty of attending. I do want to give you a tremendous yashar koach and chizuk. 15 years ago, when we tried as JAGS to present this issue at a Torah Mesorah conference, we were denied access. Today, Torah Mesorah, we cannot fill the request by yeshivas of having speakers speak at the yeshivas. I think what you need to know is there is a denial process that needs to be broken on the educational level. Okay, and all the issues that you raised, I've heard 15 years ago and 12 years ago, and as the issues become more and more aware. But the most important thing is that we have an open mind, that the problem exists. Solutions are not going to be created this afternoon, but at least the opening that maybe we have to be open to the fact that we have to create solutions. I can't expect every yeshiva to put up with every substance abuser that walks through the doors of the yeshiva. It's just not realistic. It wouldn't happen in any culture. But I think the idea of where years ago, where yeshivas would not allow the educational process to take place because they were afraid that that would be a stigma, that if yeshiva allowed discussions about substance abuse to take place, that that means that that was an activity that took place. Today, that denial has taken place, has broken in the state. So, chazak v'yametz.
Okay. I just wanted to say I thought this was a fabulous session, and just to let you all know that in 2 weeks, Amit is going to run something as well for families in crisis. The professionals, of course, are the most important and the first, but unless we combine our efforts with the parents of these children and show these children that we're all fighting for them, parents, children alike, we're all professionals, teachers, and rebbeim, that's the only way we're going to get to these kids. They're out there because no one cares, and we have to fight together to show them that we really care. My name is Sherry Miller, and I'm a guidance counselor in Yerushalayim. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a few more questions.
Okay, I'll make it fast. What Sherry said was very interesting. My name is Yehudit Spiro, and I'm from Midrashet Moriah, about the parents being involved. There is a great cover-up going on in the States, and I'm sure that many of us can attest to this. I don't want to be put as the boogeyman if we do have to throw somebody out. We're put under a lot of pressure, meaning the girls all have telephones now, the boys I'm sure all have telephones too. The minute something happens, they're on the telephone to their parents, and then I get a call a few minutes later, or somebody on the staff, what are you going to do about this problem in your school? And I thought your school's not going to have this kind of problem, and I don't want my child going to that kind of a school. So it's very complicated. Now, Dr. Goldstein talked about family support, which is very important. Very difficult to do, though, when a child is 6,000 miles away. What I'm talking about with the cover-up is I can get a beautiful application from a girl who's maybe had a drug problem, seeing a psychiatrist or a psychologist. It's completely covered up. We don't get the full information when we come here. I happen to be married to a clinical psychologist who talks about many of these kids that are sent here knowingly by their parents with a problem. He calls it Israel as therapy. My kid has a problem. I want to go to shul on Shabbos. I'm going to be able to say to my friends in Brooklyn, my kid's learning in Yerushalayim, knowing full well you sent a child with a big problem. So I can't necessarily solve a problem as much as I want to be kind and avas chesed and avas yisrael. I can't fix a problem that maybe if you would let me know that I'm getting a problem, I could be sensitive. I could be on the lookout for this child. I'd know who this person is supposed to room with. I'd know this kid has to be able to speak to somebody. But there's a great cover-up going on. We're all affected by it, and I don't know what to do about it. Okay. Over here, please.
My name's Alex Israel, teaching the Ravan in Lindenbaum. In response to this whole cover-up and the question about rejecting students, we've heard from the psychologists here that rejection is a serious problem. And then we also hear about policies of rejection. And I begin to ask myself whether the problem is that we're worried about the influence on the students we have, or we're worried about the stigmas that our institutions will have. Are we worried that maybe if we admit the problem, that our enrollment for next year will be half? And I think this relates to the problem, and admitting the problem. why don't we all make a decision here that in every yeshiva, in every stem, we say, we all have a problem. Let's turn around and say on all our applications, we have a drug, we have a policy to deal with drugs within our institution. Don't be surprised it's going to happen. It's going to happen. And let's all say it. And then there won't be any stigmas. We don't need to pretend that we're, you know, squeaky clean. It won't be squeaky clean. And let's face the problem, because that's what everybody seems to be saying. Let's just say we don't care about stigmas.
Over here, please. Is in our institutions itself. When a kid gets kicked out of yeshiva or a seminary, the yeshiva often covers up why they're being kicked out. I think it's the responsibility of all of the yeshivas and all of the seminaries to have an open policy where they're sending a kid onto to tell them what's happening, why they got kicked out, so that when you get the kid from the other institution, you're not getting any surprises and you can do what's best for the kid.
I have a question for the two panelists.
Okay, this woman down here, please, and then the man with the mic.
On the issue of openness of I'm sorry, Shani Solo, Machon Gold. On the issue of openness of institutions to other institutions, I think the bigger problem is that most of the schools don't ask. If I ask a kid to leave, I sit and wait by the phone for the administrator of the school the kid's applying to come call me and check what the problem was. More often than not, I never hear from them. If I make the contact with another institution to try to make a transfer, I obviously discuss the problem. But frequently, parents don't want to hear about the schools that I'm suggesting because those are the schools that already have the stigma of being the schools of problematic girls. They then try to get their daughters into other institutions, and those institutions, for whatever reasons, don't bother to check why the kids left. I think that it needs to work both ways. I think that many of us, most of us, are quite open about what's happening when a kid leaves the school, but we need to be asked.
I was wondering if you could talk about two issues.
Please introduce yourself.
Hi, sorry, I'm David Gleckman, a rabbinical student here in Yerushalayim. I was wondering if you could talk about two issues regarding families. One is the increase in prescription drugs being given to children, mind-altering prescription drugs such as Ritalin, et cetera, and maybe the over-prescription of those, and how that affects drug culture. And two, how to deal with issues of shame, guilt, and feelings of failure amongst families with children with drug problems.
Okay, we're going to take one more question, and then we're going to give each of our speakers 5 minutes to sum up. There's a lot to be discussed, and...
Hi, my name is Deborah Solomon, so I'm using the fact that we were co-sponsors of this day just to say something in closing. I'm going to speak not as a professional right now, but as a lay person, somebody who hosts many of these young people. Really, since we've come in Aliyah, we've had an open home, and I've noticed over the past few years in particular, a tremendous change. There is too much free time. Students come, and I don't mean to bash the yeshivot, because I think the yeshivot are great, but I think that somebody did point out the fact that the yeshivot need to look at the change in the population and change their schedules accordingly. Having a student come Rosh Chodesh Elul, and 2 weeks later is Yom Tov, a student who has no place to go. 3 weeks later it's Sukkot, and the yeshiva is closed. Where is this child going to go? And then Chodesh Nisan, it's off. I mean, either they go home, or, you know, if the parents have that extra $1,000, then they can go in Heritage. But it becomes a real problem because these are young people who have been home or in camp for 18 years and suddenly get off a plane, they are 6,000 miles away and just don't know what to do with themselves. And that really needs to be looked at. And as host families, we have a tremendous burden ourselves. When we get the call on a Thursday night from a young person who suddenly has no place to go on a Shabbat, that the yeshiva is closed, or suddenly on Erev Chag their plans changed, or suddenly because the yeshiva's policy is 2 days of a Yom Tov, where are they going to eat on that last day of Pesach when everybody is eating chametz? These are issues that are simply not addressed and looked at, and we as the hosts have that burden, and we don't get the support of the yeshivot either. The yeshivot should have a listing of the host family, should provide us with support as well. Check and see, are you having problems with these girls or boys or whatever? And that's my feeling. But I feel very strongly that the scheduling needs to be looked at and needs to be reviewed. Much less free time, much more tiulim, and much more supervision. Thank you.
Okay, we have time for one more question. The gentleman up there.
My name is Yishai Kanigsberg. I teach at Ohr Yerushalayim. I just want to add one more comment concerning the dilemma that we face from yeshiva. We need to establish red lines. We need to say that certain things are not acceptable behavior. If a student is using drugs, even casually, and we allow him to remain in the student body, the student body is aware of that, that sends a certain message to the students. We are on a certain level condoning that behavior. And on the other hand, we're trying to say it's usher, we don't want to be permissive, we want to say this is not acceptable. But on the other hand, by allowing the student to remain, other students are getting a certain message. So we want to save the 10-15% who are having this problem, but on the other hand, we are find ourselves in a dilemma. How do we get across to the rest of the student body that this is not acceptable behavior? I think this is part of the dilemma. It's not just stigma, we're not just out to save our own skins, it's not just that we can't admit there's a drug problem. There's an educational philosophy behind the secrecy and behind this idea of not allowing the students to remain in the student body.
Okay, now I'd like to ask our speakers to take a few minutes each to sum up.
I would just like to answer a couple of the questions that came up. I don't think that last comment, for example, helping a kid realize a mitzvah is what the yeshiva is all about. If you had a kid who wasn't so IAI on some aspects of Shmirat Shabbat or masturbation or whatever, you would not say, you know, Chok v'lo yavor, get him out of here. You would educate him, you would relate to him, you would express your philosophy in the particular area, and over a period of time, the kid would come over to your way of thinking. By all means, do not accept a kid using drugs in your program. Then you proceed to educate him. The issue is not he's some sort of who knows what, he can't stay here. That's exactly what the educational process is. If we were all tzaddikim, we wouldn't need a yeshiva. It's because it's the educational process that moves us toward that. I completely agree.
No,
I'm not saying that. I am not saying that. Absolutely. Absolutely there are. But it ought not be the first thing that comes to mind. We're not going to save every kid. But a lot of these kids are salvageable. They are salvageable. And we need to put in the energy and the drive. These kids are not different from any of the other kids. Only we know about them. And their particular action is more noticeable, it's more difficult, has more pitfalls than others. I don't disagree with you. I think the yeshiva has to be aware about what next year's enrollment is going to be. If there is a kid who's committed to who knows what, of course the kid can't be in the yeshiva, and there are always administrative red lines. If you have a program, again, where 99% of the kids are terrific on an issue, you can allow another kid there to be influenced by those 99 kids. Why is the influence all the other way? Being permissive never works with any of these issues. Somebody questioned Ritalin. Ritalin, there's only one problem with Ritalin, is that when prescribed appropriately, it works terrifically well. And if you see a kid who can't focus and can't learn, and you prescribe the right amount of stimulant and it works for him, then there's no greater achievement for that kid than Ritalin. Up until recently, I don't know how recently means, Ritalin was not abused. It is now abused. It's second cousin to ecstasy. It's second cousin to a whole bunch of things. And kids are now stealing pills from younger kids who are who are prescribed Ritalin. I, to my knowledge, when prescribed appropriately, it's a terrific medication, and nobody needs to apologize for prescribing it to kids when it then allows them and enables them to learn. Is there an abuse possibility? Absolutely. There's an abuse possibility for Robitussin. There's an abuse possibility for any one of a million things that we don't take off the market just because, only because of that. Ritalin is not an overprescribed, overused medication, and when prescribed correctly, it's really terrific. Have a last word.
Okay. A couple of points that I think are important. First of all, I'm not impressed, but I'm very happy because I wouldn't expect less really from the kinds of people that are here with the questions that have been asked and the issues that have been brought up. It's very good stuff. You know, it's we are dealing with hard questions, and the answers are not so simple. We have an expression in the recovery business. We say that recovery is a process. It's not an event. It doesn't happen like that, like a birthday. You know, a birthday comes and then it's gone. Recovery is a process. And dealing with these problems that we have as a community, as Rebbeim, as professionals, as, you know, outreach people, is also a process. We're not going to just fix it like that because we recognize there's problems and we have to get the problems fixed right away. But as Izzy Fogel said over here, it took 15 years before you could get some of these issues. The Jewish Observer, I understand, was contacted 5 years ago to do an article on this problem. They denied there was a problem. They said an article would make the problem worse. You know, there's two ways to look at things. A cup is half empty, cup is half full. I mean, we also got to understand it's half full. And it's getting fuller with good stuff and good people and time and process. And funding is also important. Hopefully it can get fuller. Next, I wanted to say that this gentleman that spoke about a policy statement, I think excellent idea. It's not so simple, though, but I think it's a very good point. And I think that what's happening, though, is that as a result of these kinds of conferences and these kinds of articles and more and more of these workshops and more of these gatherings, it's being known that there is a problem. And there's a problem in our yeshivas everywhere, and there's a problem in Israel. And I think a lot of people know today that Israel is not the answer to America's problems. We are known as America's garbage can. Chas v'shalom, but we are. That's unfortunate. You take a kid, he's got a problem, you know, he's got any kind of a problem, send him to Israel. And either he's going to get it from the army, and that will fix him, or he's going to go to the kotel, and they'll make him religious, or he's going to end up, you know, going to a kibbutz and make a mensch out of him, or he'll meet a nice Jewish girl, and he'll eat chicken soup forever. That's a problem. It's not true. You know, we don't have to take that role. We have enough good parts to Israel that we don't have to accept that unfortunate responsibility. And we can't fix every kid. We have to understand, though, that we're limited, and we move and we try and we keep working to the best of our ability to do it. Statement over here about getting problems and not knowing you're getting problems. Psychological, psychiatric, not substance abuse, whatever kind of problems. Okay, in line with some kind of a policy statement, you know, which, I mean, I don't think we're so far away from maybe putting on an application to any yeshiva that, you know, unfortunately, you know, in Eretz Yisrael, you know, since we are, you know, receiving American, you know, kids, and we do find from time to time that we're getting certain kinds of problems, which we don't know about before we get them. Whether they're substance abuse, whether they're overeating, whether they're psychological or psychiatric. And we are letting you know that if you tell us there's a problem before, to whatever way that we can do this, we are more prepared to deal with it. We have professional staff, professional people that maybe can help us. If you don't, then we might at that point have to tell you, you know, that we have to remove your kid from the yeshiva, unfortunately. So I don't know the answers, but you know, these questions are good questions. And you know,
The point over here about red lines, Are there no red lines? It's a very good point. You know, we have to follow, I think, in anything we do, we have to follow Chazal, we have to follow Torah. And we see in Torah, you have two midos upon which the world was created. Rakamim and Din. Not just Din. If it was Din, it wouldn't work. We have Din, we have 613 mitzvahs, and we have Yom Kippur. Where are the red lines in Yom Kippur? I'm not saying there are no red lines. We have that part of the system. We have a system that understands that. This is what we expect of you, but when you can't do it, then we understand how to deal with that. We have to build that into our system. It's very nice to say, throw a kid out, don't accept a kid, all these things. We're not in that world anymore. Unfortunately, we have a different population we're dealing with, and we have to accept that population. We have to get out of denial as much as the addict and as much as the rest of the Jewish community. We don't have to like it. I tell kids I work with, you don't have to like it, you just have to do it. Same thing here.
Just one last sentence that I feel I have to say. Many years I send numbers of kids to a lot of the one-year or Shana Bet programs here in Israel. They do spectacularly well. The Rabbanim relate to them, they're warm, they come away committed Jews. It erodes a little bit when they get back to the States and get back to the yeshivas there, but that's a different story. But I it's a terrific program. I don't know why we're talking only about the lack of success. I can tell you about many positive identity successes from sending kids to one-year programs in Israel. I just wouldn't want the impression to be doom and gloom, because it ain't.
Some articles are. What you can do is you can contact Rabbi Sachs, myself, and there's a new one being made, and I'm sure Ohel Nefesh would facilitate. Pardon? It's out already? Would facilitate distribution? I hear it's out. It's on the web.
Okay. I'd like to thank Yonah Pollack and Dr. Edwin Goldstein and all of you for your comments and questions. Just a few announcements. The first one is that we have a buffet dinner for those who called ahead of time, and one of the reasons is to allow everyone here to discuss with each other these issues, to speak to the our experts here, and we hope that the conversations will continue. The buffet dinner is in the restaurant downstairs. I would also like to ask everyone to please, if you didn't already do so, sign in outside. We'd like to be in touch with you about further events of this nature. Please don't forget. And I'd like to invite everyone to Mincha, both men and women, and with Machitza, there is, if you're worried, downstairs, either this way or out over there, and you go downstairs. And the next session will begin at 6:45 sharp. Thank you.